This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. Today's topic is going to be exercise physiology, and particularly we're going to be talking about cold air or air that we breathe in exercise, and even more particularly in elite athletes. We've had the pleasure of having Dr. Michael Cole joining us from the University of British Columbia. He's on by telephone. Dr. Cole is an MD, PhD, who studies the respiratory effects of various and sundry environmental issues on exercise physiology, and he's a sports medicine expert as well. Before I say hi to Dr. Cole, I want to just mention that the topic of this program had its origins when a friend of mine let me know that they wanted to know more about reasons for having the U.S. cross-country ski championships in Anchorage last winter having to be postponed and delayed because of temperature, and what's the physiologic rationale for that. So we're going to be addressing those specific issues as well as we can, and then letting the program go where it will otherwise. Dr. Cole, welcome to Line One. It's a pleasure to have you joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the anatomy and physiology of the lungs and the respiratory tract. What's the purpose? What's going on there? And then we'll talk about what happens when those airways are injured in some way.
Okay. I guess the main purpose of the lungs is to provide oxygen to the body. Oxygen is necessary for just about everything we do, using our muscles and using our brains and using all our organs. And so we need to find a way to get the oxygen out of the air around us, and specifically to get that oxygen into the blood. So the way the lungs work is there's sort of an interface between the outside environment and the blood. And I guess the way it's set up is basically a series of pipes set up as arranged like a tree with a number of branches, and as you go further into the lungs, the branches get narrower and narrower until you get the very smallest parts of the lung, which we call the alveoli, but they're shaped like little bunches of grapes, and that's where the outside air meets the blood system. And that's where the oxygen enters the blood, and then we also get rid of our waste products. And for us, that's the carbon dioxide that we produce. So that that occurs at a membrane between the blood and the lung there at the bottom of the lung there. And the important thing to know is that to some extent our body controls the diameter of these tubes with muscles called smooth muscles, that their job is to open and close the diameter of the airways. And that when we have problems there, that's where we get into issues with things like asthma.
So those smooth muscles will open larger, for example, when we're exercising or under a stress to allow us to move more oxygen, and may close paradoxically a little bit more than usual with a noxious chemical such as cold air or smoke that or something that gets into the lungs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. And then when they close at an inappropriate time, then that's when a person may have difficulty getting the air in and out, and specifically breathing the air out.
And before we concentrate too hard on the lungs, the upper airway, our nose, has some functions which we all realize, which is to smell, but it does some other things as well. You want to discuss the purpose of the nose besides smelling?
Yeah, certainly. It does two things to the air as we breathe it in. It heats it up, and it humidifies it. So by the time the air gets all the way down to the alveoli, the connection with the blood supply, the air should be at our body temperature and it should be completely humidified. And that's the goal of the nose.
So how does it accomplish that? Just simply, I don't want to get into the deep even biochemistry, but what's the function of the membrane that lines the airway? Is that part of how this all happens?
Yeah, because of the we have a moist membrane inside the back of our throat and inside the nose and then all the way down the tree. As we get further and further down the tree, the actual surface area gets very, very high. So with a high surface area, we're able to heat and humidify the air so well.
And I'm going to ask you to define a couple of other terms that may be important to understand as we talk about injury to the airway, and that is inflammation, particularly of the airway, and what's called airway hyperresponsiveness or bronchial hyperresponsiveness.
Yeah. So inflammation, I guess, it means that there's a – it's a process that the body does in response to a stimulus, and usually it means that the immune system is playing a role, perhaps to try and heal. And the immune system brings in certain chemicals and certain cells from the body, the white blood cells, as well as typically with inflammation, there's a swelling component. So there's an actual increase in blood flow to the area. So if you looked at a inflamed airway, it would be the lining would be more swollen, and you would have more mucus there blocking the way. And so, if you're thinking of your airway being a narrow pipe, and you actually thicken the wall of the pipe, that's going to make it even narrower. So that's one of the mechanisms that you would have for airway narrowing in someone with asthma. Then the other mechanism is the response of the bronchioles, which are the tubes where the smooth muscles constrict and further narrow the airway as well. So you can have two separate processes that are contributing to narrowing of the airways.
And so we've got this increased mucus, this swelling, which is a component of the injury or the some damage to an airway and the bronchoconstriction. And then that leads to what kind of symptoms in particular?
I guess the most common thing that you'd feel is feeling short of breath, so you can't catch your breath. Sometimes they use the word dyspnea, which sort of means difficulty breathing. And as part of that, you can have what's called a wheeze, where there's a sound made as you're trying to breathe out through those narrowed airways. So perhaps wheezing, being short of breath, and then the other thing that you can often get is coughing. So that irritation of the inside of the airways of the lungs can be irritating, and people respond with a cough.
So cough, shortness of breath, and perhaps wheeze or feeling short of breath are the common symptoms of some kind of respiratory illness or disorder, I guess is the best way to put it. The other thing, having done and seen patients with asthma for a long time, is another key component, it seems to me, of asthma is variability. And I talk to patients about just like we all know some people have more sensitive skin. Well, some people have more sensitive respiratory tracts or epithelium or the lining of our inside of our body. Is that an issue that you think about or observe when we talk about people who might be having symptoms related to cold air or pollution or some of the studies you're involved in with sports medicine?
Yeah, certainly. I guess the easiest people to sort out are the people that have asthma all the time. And so if they have triggers such as pollution or pollen or something like that that causes asthma, and then when they exercise, they also get similar symptoms. that's much more clear when you're trying to make a diagnosis and then to try to treat it. When it becomes difficult is the people that have symptoms perhaps only with exercise and or only with exercise and cold air. Because it's sometimes it's quite difficult to actually demonstrate that. So if you have an athlete who's competing at a high level, because of rules with doping and such, they can only take asthma medications if you've proven that they have asthma. And if someone has asthma all the time and it's there's a lot of triggers for them, it's quite easy to prove that they have asthma. Usually they do the sort of standard test at the hospital or the lung function lab where they measure a bunch of different ways of measuring the volumes of your lung, and then they will give you a medication that will either improve your lung function or they'll give you one that will actually trigger an asthma attack. With these people that get asthma-type symptoms only during exercise, sometimes it's harder. Sometimes they'll actually go to the hospital to get all that testing done, and it's totally normal. And so for those people, there's extra tests that are tried to try to document this asthma, because if you can't prove it with a lab test, then the sporting bodies and the anti-doping bodies won't allow the athlete to take the medication.
So in just to maybe help listeners understand this a little bit, asthma, just to define that, and this is an oversimplification, is an oversensitivity of that airway so that there may be make mucus a little easier than other people. The airway will contract down a little bit more and maybe even swell a little to a little bit greater response. And all of those might be induced by somebody really working hard in cold air. And so a very, very mild asthmatic and a very, very sensitive person's respiratory tract who doesn't have asthma may be very hard to decipher or tease between the two. Is that kind of what we're saying?
Yeah, that's it. And then the other part of it is some people with asthma, or more commonly with asthma, you can have these sort of classic triggers. This they call it atopy, or where they things like dust mites will trigger it. Mm-hmm. And with the people that only have it with exercise, they're not sensitive to those types of triggers. And it seems to be in those people, it seems to be related to the high volume of air that's going in and out through the lungs at a rapid rate. And what that does is it causes cooling and drying of the airways, which is the trigger for those people, whereas maybe some of the more classic triggers aren't effective at triggering their symptoms.
And I'm guessing as well as if an elite athlete, just to use that term, is working out very, very hard and they're moving more and more air into their lung than a normal person will be, and it may be have relative amounts of humidity or it may have relative amounts of coolness because it overwhelms that respiratory tract ability to warm the air. It may also have ozone or fine particulates or other things that we classify as pollution, and they also have their effects.
Yeah, perhaps.
Well, not so sure. I was going to say, oh yeah. Okay.
Well, the way that I'm sort of talking about how we try and show that people with that don't have asthma on their standard asthma test, they only get it with exercise. Exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, they call it. How do we test for that? The most effective test that we use is something called eukapnic voluntary hyperpnea. And what that means is that it's sort of doctor talk for you're breathing really, really hard, but we're giving you a gas so that when you breathe hard, it doesn't make you lightheaded. Because if you breathe really hard right now, you're going to hyperventilate and get rid of too much of the body's carbon dioxide, and that actually affects the acidity of the blood, and then you get lightheaded. So the test that we do is we have these people, breathe at a very high level, in liters per minute, they're sometimes breathing 130 liters per minute. So, I don't know, that's 40 or 50 gallons a minute for 6 minutes from a pure air source. So there's no pollution whatsoever in it. And it's just that high volume of air that's dry and cooling that can trigger their asthma. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to have them breathe as hard as they would, say, at climbing a hill in a very difficult cross-country ski race, but without anything else and without the exercise component to it. And just that, just the high volumes going through should be enough to trigger the bronchoconstriction in these people.
All right, so that's one of the better validated tests to try to differentiate this issue we were discussing earlier about what's really, really mild asthma triggered by exercise and what's what may appear to be asthma but is really otherwise doesn't fit the clinical description of it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Let me
go ahead.
All right. I was going to just open the phones up. I was going to make sure our listeners know that if they have questions or comments today about what they're hearing, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our outside toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, or you can email me directly at lineone, all one word spelled out, at kska.org. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 local time, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. It's live only between Mondays between 2 and 3 Anchorage time. Did you have some more comments? I interrupted Dr. Cole.
We were just talking about the two tests, the test for exercise-induced bronchoconstriction. The other test, the one that's the gold standard, is actually get the person to do the exercise that triggers it. So for a cross-country skier, ideally what they would do is they would cross-country ski as hard as they can outdoors in cold weather and then measure their lung function. But you can imagine that's not a very practical thing to do in most situations. But that's the best test if somebody can actually do that.
We've talked a lot about so far how the lungs are working and then a little bit about effects on the lung and the injury, but we really didn't talk about how does the lung change in any specific way to adapt to exercise to make it more effective that we maybe should to talk about as well. Are there some adaptions to that? And then if there are, is there something that happens over the long term to people who are elite athletes and train very more difficultly? Do they have different lungs in some way that might be important for us to understand?
Yeah, it's somewhat disappointing because you'd think that if you trained really hard, you'd make your lungs larger and such. But your lung volume, the actual volume of your lung, because it's constrained, it's stuck in the rib cage, and your ribs aren't going to change. The actual pure volume of your lung will not change over time. The most rapid thing that happens is that the muscles, your respiratory muscles, the muscles that control breathing, they will get stronger. And there's a lot of research lately for elite athletes that are specifically trying to strengthen their lung, their breathing muscles. So they're going to the gym and doing squats so they can cycle harder or ski harder, but a lot of the time they hadn't done any specific training for their lung muscles. So there's a lot of devices on the market that will actually provide resistance so that you can challenge the breathing muscles. And so that's probably the most important change that happens. Because when you're exercising at a very high level, there's quite a significant proportion of your blood supply is devoted to breathing. So in a very high-performance athlete doing a whole-body exercise, it can be up to a sixth or a seventh of their blood volume is just being used for breathing. So if you can make your lungs more efficient and perhaps you can use less of your body's demands, or I guess place lower demands on your body. So there has been some studies that show that people that train these muscles actually get stronger. They perform better. In terms of the the shape of the airways or the number of the airways, that won't change over time. So in terms of the main beneficial changes of exercise, it's in terms of the muscle. There are some non-beneficial or counterproductive changes with long-term training, and it's specifically, it's probably most important or interesting to Alaskans because a lot of the research is done in the Iditarod dogs, because sled dogs are an excellent model for high-performance athletes. If you think of Lance Armstrong, his when they test fitness, they do the VO2 max test, which is sort of a test of how much oxygen or how much fuel your body can burn at maximum output. And he's somewhere in the range of 80 is his VO2 max score. The units are milliliters per kilogram per minute. But a sled dog would be 240. So your average sled dog is using three times the amount of oxygen per unit mass as Lance Armstrong, who is, you know, one of the best cyclists around. So you can imagine.
And what's my VMAX likely to be?
Having never met you,
sedentary 61.
average for I guess you're probably about 24 or 25 years old. So it's about 45, and then it goes down about 10% per decade from there.
All right. So Lance is twice what you'd expect somebody his age at least to be and his ability to do that. And other cyclists are not as good as he is, I suspect, either. Huh?
Well, it's interesting because it's almost like it's only one variable. It's like looking at cars and their racetrack time. The one with the biggest horsepower may not be the fastest.
I got you. Okay. All right. Well, we need to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're talking about exercise physiology in the lung, particularly cold air, a lot of emphasis on elite athletes, particularly cross-country skiing, with Dr. Michael Cole, a researcher in the area at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Cole, we've talked about exercise. We've mentioned swimming a little bit in cycling. Is the type of exercise being done a very important variable in the effects that we're seeing? It's a slightly different way to ask the questions we've been drilling in on.
Yeah. Both swimming and cross-country skiing are probably the sports that are most affected, and because of that, they're the ones that are most studied. And actually, we're starting to talk about sort of the downsides of long-term exercise or high-level exercise on your lungs. And the term for that is ski asthma, because it's most common in cross-country skiers. And the reason that these sports are particularly effective, well, cross-country skiing is and swimming, you both use a large percentage of your entire body. Your arms and your legs are kicking. So because you're using so much of your muscles, you need a lot of oxygen. Because you need a lot of oxygen, you have to breathe more. So both of those activities have a lot of a high volume of air going in and out of your lungs, and you can imagine that that would cause more drying and cooling of the lungs. The cross-country skiing has the cold air, which seems to be a potential trigger, and then the swimming has the noxious chemicals such as the chlorine that may be triggers as well. So that's why those two are the sports that are most commonly associated with exercise-induced bronchoconstriction and sort of the long-term effects of these sports on the lungs.
Well, let's talk about that last issue a little bit. are we aware, are we learning that there are, I'm going to try to choose my words carefully, deleterious effects on the lungs in elite athletes who exercise over long, many years? Is that good or bad, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at in what way?
Well, yeah, so there is this phenomenon called ski asthma that is basically what it is in people that are previously healthy and they participate in a sport like cross-country skiing at a high level, percentage of people that get exercise-induced asthma goes up over time. So if you look at people that have been training at cross-country skiing for 10 years, there'd be a higher percentage of them who have exercise-induced bronchoconstriction than people that had just started for 1 year. And that seems to go up over time. The interesting thing about it is recently they're starting to find that after these people quit, it goes away again. Although there, in the short term, there seem to be deleterious effects, we're not sure that down the road there are any deleterious effects. And you can imagine that there's a lot of health effects from being that fit for that long on your lungs, your heart, your bones, your brain, everything. And there'd be no evidence to say that you'd be more at risk of something like emphysema or chronic bronchitis or any of the chronic lung conditions that happen down the road. So this is something that's been only studied in the last 10 years and a lot in the last 5 years. So we're sort of at the really early learning phases of that. But that is something that we're learning at, and hopefully it's reversible, so it's not too concerning.
So I guess I was not as aware of that, and it's interesting. And I guess one of the conclusions, the hypothesis you might make is that that is a consequence of, what am I going to say, inflammation of cold air, pollutants, and so forth in the air that is transient and not permanent, as opposed to an asthmatic lung who often has some rather long-term consequences of their inflammation. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost that you're getting a little bit of damage that heals up over time, where you're not seeing that so much in the asthma. And that's where I started to get into the sled dogs. That's how they first really discovered it, is they somehow got, I forget how many, but quite a few dogs right after the race. And within 24 to 48 hours, they used the camera to go down the lungs of the dogs and then collect the fluid in the lungs and look for these immune system cells in the lungs of the dogs, and that's what they found. And I think they did a follow-up about 4 months later, and they still showed signs of, for lack of a better word, a bit of a damage in the airways of the dogs. Mm-hmm. But in humans, it seems to resolve as fast or faster than in the dogs, mm-hmm. perhaps because we're nowhere near as fit.
And it at least raises the high potential that the true asthmatic has a genetic underpinning to their problem, whereas the person who exercises and gets this transient inflammatory change that appears to go away when the irritant is stopped may not have that, and so that they're truly different problems.
Yeah, no, you're right. There may not be that inherited predisposition to it as much as you would find with asthma.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners again, if you have questions or comments about the program today, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email me directly at line1, spell it out, LINEONE, at KSKA.org. So I mentioned at the top of the show, Dr. Cole, that what initiated this particular program was the question of why the U.S. National Cross Country Ski Championships in Anchorage last winter were delayed and postponed over a period of time. I was informed by the individuals interested in this that the International Ski Federation standards are that these cross-country races cannot be held if the temperature anywhere on the course is less than negative 20 degrees centigrade, which is negative 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So I need to ask the specific question about your comments about why regulation may be in place, and maybe even venture out with some politics to ask you if you think it's a reasonable regulation or requirement.
Yeah, so certainly that's the rule, and basically there's sort of two criteria for that rule. One is that they have a hard criterion, which is this minus 20 degrees centigrade anywhere on the course, and often that means that the race will be postponed for an hour or two until the sun gets warm, but it sounds like last year it was for more like a day or two. And then there's a secondary criterion in that if there's any other situation, either very high wind or precipitation, that they think it's going to be increase the risk of a cold injury on the athletes, the race can be postponed as well. So if it's, say, only 0 degrees Fahrenheit, but it's extremely windy, they can still postpone the race. And so that certainly happens pretty frequently. I've covered a lot of cross-country ski races in my career, and I'm going to be working as part of the medical for the cross-country for the Olympics. And I'd say it happens at least 10% of events, and maybe a little bit more just in southern Canada. And the reason for that, at least in my experience, has not been particularly respiratory, and that it's there's a higher incidence of cold injury, meaning frostbite and frostnip, because these athletes are wearing lycra and spandex and very very little clothing, and they often have parts of their noses almost always exposed and parts of their ears, so you will see. After the event, you'll see pretty commonly you can see frostbite. And when you're doing the medical coverage for these, the biggest job for the ski patrollers isn't worrying about trauma or big injuries. It's worrying about frostbite and potentially hypothermia. You can imagine that if it's extremely cold outside and an athlete is out on a far part of the course and they get injured and they're lying there in sweaty lycra and it's minus 30 centigrade out and it takes them time for the ski patrollers to get to them and get them to the medical tent, you can imagine that they'd also be at risk of hypothermia. So I don't think there's any evidence that there's any true short-term respiratory effects when it's that cold, but it's more the cold injury and the hypothermia that become an issue with these kind of athletes.
Okay. So you would rationalize that these regulations and suggested standards are reasonable?
I would, I guess for those reasons. Mm-hmm. Certainly there's a lot of race officials breathing on the thermometer and stuff. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But we had talked that they might have to increase that temperature up to something like 0 degrees, and that seems really extremely warm. It's quite difficult to even wax your skis for that. I can't imagine that actually being feasible. There's very few places that can be consistently that warm and still have good cross-country skiing. So I think they're pretty reasonable, and most of the time it's only a race delay for a few hours, and most of the athletes are very used to this program, this occurrence, I guess. Just means they often have to sit around while they get their skis re-waxed a few times during the morning.
Okay.
As conditions change.
All right. Dr. Cole, we do have three phone calls that are holding right now, so I want to go ahead and try to take those. First, it's Diane. Diane, welcome to Line 1.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I don't know if you covered this, but for a recreational skier, not a big-time athlete, with minimal, almost asymptomatic asthma and minimal medications, or for people who have really a lot of asthma, just how shall they adjust their inhalers, or should there be any adjustment for when they're skiing, and how would one know whether or not they're being affected by the cold? Certainly not down to as cold as the skiers are are probably going to be skiing at. But how do you know whether it's your medication, your asthma, or the cold that may be producing lack of ability to ski or other symptoms?
Yeah. Sure. So it's a good question, Diane. So the first thing to do is to make sure that if you can, if you're skiing recreationally and it's cold enough, if you're wearing a scarf or a mask, that'll help you heat up and humidify the air, which is one of the really important triggers. So that would be probably step one. And then as step two is, if you are on minimal medications, usually when people are on minimal medications, they're just on the bronchodilator. Usually that's called albuterol or Ventolin. And that's sometimes they call that the rescue medication because it works quite quickly. And the recommendation for that is that you just take your regular dose of that 15 minutes before you start doing your exercise. And then the other thing that's important, especially with exercise-induced asthma, is it's got something called a refractory period, meaning that initially, if someone has had a bout of asthma associated with exercise, then for a period of a few hours afterwards, they become resistant to asthma. And that's called the refractory period. So when people are getting ready to exercise, what has been shown to make a difference is if they have a pretty good warm-up. And not just a slow, gradual warm-up, but warm-up of at least 15 minutes, but with a couple of bouts of pretty hard exercise. So as hard as you're anticipating that you're going to go during your ski. And that's supposed to cause a very, very minor exacerbation of your asthma that triggers this protective effect, this protective refractory period. And that seems to make people feel it less.
Interesting. And what about Pulmicort besides albuterol as an inhaler? Is there any difference in the use of that?
So its job is to reduce the amount of inflammation in the lungs. So when you take it, it doesn't give you a benefit over, say, the next hour. It's more benefiting you over weeks to days to months. So I wouldn't change the amount of that. I would stay consistent with that, with the Pulmicort. And rely more on the albuterol for that.
Great. Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, Diane, I might use the analogy also, since I do a lot of asthma, I try to help patients understand Pulmicort's more like a leather jacket you're wearing every day to try to decrease the inflammation, the sensitivity, whereas the albuterol is a little bit more like pain medicine. It works very, very quickly in case you have symptoms, but it has the additional benefit of maybe preventing some acute symptoms like before exercise. Is that
right? Yeah, I sort of knew that, but I didn't know if it should be changed during an exercise. But I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yep, you bet. Okay, let's go to Vern. You're on line one. Oh, yeah, we got Vern. We got you on line one.
Here.
We got Rebecca?
No, Vern.
Vern, okay, I'm sorry. What can we do for you?
You touched on this lightly with the previous caller, but I was a marathon runner for 13, 14 years in Alaska, and I trained in the wintertime. And I'm just curious if there's been any research with respect to respiratory illness or damage from runners who ran in the wintertime up here, and it would seem to me that there would be more oxygen intake be a swimmer or a cross-country skier. I could maybe could address that.
Okay, sorry, Vern, it cut out just when you started to talk about oxygen intake as compared to a cross-country skier.
Yes, I was saying for a marathon runner, I was curious if there was any potential injury to a runner training in an Arctic environment like we do in Alaska here, and if there was any research on oxygen intake injury from long-distance runners who also take in a lot of oxygen.
Yeah. Well, there isn't specific research, but you should basically consider yourself equivalent to a cross-country skier when you're running in those kind of conditions, because the amount of oxygen that you're using is comparable to a cross-country skier, and you're in the same weather conditions. So you'd be probably just as at risk of having that ski asthma, so that temporary exercise-induced asthma that occurs during your periods of high training, but would eventually hopefully resolve when your training settles down or you move to New Mexico or something like that.
Okay, so there's a comparable exposure to cross-country skier and a marathon runner training in Arctic environment then.
Yeah, certainly. You get very similar levels of oxygen consumption.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm really enjoying your program.
Okay great. Thanks, Vern.
All right. Let's take, is it Rebecca? Or are you on line one now?
Yes.
All right. What can we do for you?
Yes. Thanks for taking my call, gentlemen. After quite a few years of running sled dogs recreationally and having been a cross-country skier for probably more than 30 years, I started ski drawing competitively at the age of 47 this past winter. And we ran some of our races at 20 to 25 below because these are like mushing clubs and their cutoff is much colder than, say, ski clubs. Of course, we're covering our faces at those temperatures, but with the exertion, I mean, we have these really fast sprint dogs. We're skate skiing for anywhere nonstop between 4 to 6 miles. And sometimes having the mouth covered, I mean, I know it's the best thing to do, but it's like you can't get in enough air. And I'm wondering, even at, say, you know, 5 below, 10 below, something like that, when we're not covering our mouths, what can we do? I feel like, you know, towards the end of these races, and you can be honest with me, maybe it's just because I'm, you know, 47, I mean, now I'm 48, and I'm going to be racing as long as I can to get more air in. I mean, I'm hiking in the summer, staying in shape, or is it just the way I'm put together in my age? Is there some way to train my lungs before the season so that I can be getting more oxygen in?
Yeah, definitely. So hiking is great for your base, so your ability to exercise for a long period of time at a moderate intensity. But skate skiing for 4 to 6 miles is a very different challenge on your system. So if in the summer you can have something that's of comparable intensity, so, you know, things like mountain biking, or ideally if you can actually have the intensity increase, so mountain bike racing, or say, you know, even doing running races or something like that, where you're having to ventilate, you're having to breathe at a really high level for a long period of time in an activity where you're using a lot of your body's muscle mass. That's the most important part.
Okay, and I'm also finding that, say, when I race in Fairbanks, of course, it's so dry, and I'm finding that must make it more difficult as well. So other than drinking a lot of water and staying hydrated, those are probably going to help me the most as far as the whole process and being able to get in as much oxygen as I can.
Yeah, staying hydrated is super important. Probably the other thing that's important is having a really high carbohydrate diet, because that helps you store more water. And if there's a reasonable amount of salt in your diet, that may be helpful as well to sort of really load up, because you're right, when you're breathing that much, you lose a lot of water just through your mouth.
But will I notice that in the breathing itself, though? Will I feel like I'm getting more of what I need when I'm out there? Because, you know, this is like open-mouth breathing during these races. And so should I feel a difference just with that? I mean, I tried to load up on the carbs and drink a lot of water. But would I notice that difference in, say, you know, the last mile of a race with all the heavy breathing that I'm doing?
Yeah. Well, if the problem occurs mostly at the last mile of the race, that makes it sound like there is a fatigue component to it, and so that's why doing the high intensity stuff during the summer may reduce the chance that fatigue is playing a role in that. So that's okay. Probably what I'd really recommend is have some sort of high intensity or interval work throughout the year, just to keep that up, and don't just attribute it to age. You can certainly overcome a bit of that.
Well, I'm feeling pretty good, and of course the great dogs are really keeping us going. So I appreciate your input, and I'll keep really busy this summer and start getting ready for winter now.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Thanks for your call,
thanks
Rebecca.
So yep.
Thanks, Rebecca.
All right, just a reminder again, if you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, a toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. We've got a little over, maybe 12 or 13 minutes left, or you can email directly at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, I'm sorry, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at KSKA.org. With the last caller, Dr. Cole, I'm going to ask something for my own benefit. My understanding is that after most of us, depending on male or female, hit around 20 to 30, our lung caliber, airway size of these tree branches that we've described in our lungs that get smaller and smaller out towards the alveoli begin to actually decrease in size, so that we're losing some ability to move air in and out as efficiently over time as we age. And you didn't mention that with the last caller. Is that correct? And if it is correct, is it not that significant of an issue? I mean, most of us don't recognize or feel that difference. Even patients with asthma may not notice that they're losing that ability more, which they may do more rapidly than a normal person.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I hadn't heard anything about airway caliber with age. Certainly, there are a lot of things that will affect exercise performance with age, mm-hmm. and by far the most important thing is muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So after about 30, early 30s, your body basically wants to try to lose muscle, and that includes mostly locomotion muscles, but also you get some changes in the heart as well. And the people that are able to maintain their muscle mass, they can maintain their performance over time. And they've done some interesting studies where they match people based on just lean muscle mass over time, and they find that their performance isn't really getting that much slower if they can keep the muscle mass. And they can also reverse it. So if you found that, at 50 you weren't as fit as you were at 40, or perhaps you weren't as fast as you were at 40, but over the next 5 years you can really rebuild the muscle mass and keep the intensity in your training, you can reverse those changes. The other thing that they find over time is that your maximum heart rate decreases, and most people have often heard that formula to calculate your maximum heart rate is 220 minus your age. And the reason, the place that comes from is that typically your heart rate, your maximum heart rate goes down one beat per year as you get older. But if people are training at a high level, probably high as Rebecca or Vern, they will find that decrease is much slower. So a lot of the changes that people are attributing with age are actually changes that maybe relate more to loss of muscle mass and loss of training time. Because as people get families and jobs and stuff like that, they often find it's a lot harder to train at the same level that they trained at age 21.
Okay. And while we're on this topic, I'm going to gradually move into some issues related to asthma, which we have mentioned several times, but we haven't specifically talked about. But before we go there, maybe I should ask about the effects of altitude on training and how does that work physiologically?
Sure. With altitude, atmospheric pressure gets less, so then the air becomes thinner, but the actual percentage of oxygen, or the fraction of air that's made up of oxygen, doesn't change. It's just that for a given volume, there's less air. So as people go higher, there's less oxygen available. So they usually make up for that, if they're exercising, by breathing more. So breathing a higher volume of air into their lungs in a minute. That's particularly important to Alaskans, because as you get further north, as further away from the equator, the air also becomes less dense as well. So they often talk about climbers on Denali or McKinley. The altitude of Denali feels higher than it actually is, because it's so far north the way it has to do with, you probably get a physicist getting on the phone and correcting me here, but I think it has to do with the spin of the Earth. The atmosphere is ends up being thicker at the equators and thinner at the poles, and that's why Denali can be such a, one of the reasons it can be such a challenge, is that for a given altitude, your body feels higher than it is, because there's less oxygen there than it is. And that relates to performance then, because oxygen is your main fuel. You combine that with carbohydrates or fat to release energy. And if there's less oxygen available, then that then your performance is decreased. And then to go on to that, some people use altitude as a training tool. So you hear about athletes that are sleeping at high altitude and then to improve their performance. And the main reason for that is they want to increase the ability of their blood to carry oxygen. And the way that the body responds to living at altitude, it does many things, but the most important thing probably for exercise performance is that it increases the amount of red blood cells in your blood, the blood cells that carry the oxygen. And so when people are trying to cheat, and they, especially in sports like cross-country skiing and cycling, they'll do things like either putting someone else's blood in their body to increase the amount of blood, or they take their own blood out and they store it for a while, and then they make some of their own, and then they reintroduce their own blood. And then more recently, perhaps over the last 10 years, they just take a hormone called EPO, which tells their body to make more blood. So those are all I guess illegal ways of trying to simulate living, the effects of living at altitude.
With asthma, we've talked to a caller, and we've mentioned some medications that are useful. And back at the beginning of the program, I believe we alluded to the fact that if you have asthma and you can document that you have asthma by certain tests, then these medications become legal. In our correspondence before the program, you brought up some interesting points about the amount of asthma medications being used and how well patients or athletes with asthma seem to be doing. You want to make some comments on that?
Yeah, I guess it's a bit of an elephant in the room, in that every year or every Olympic Games, the number of athletes that ask for permission to use asthma medications at the Olympics increases, and the concern is that the number of athletes that the athletes that use asthma medications are disproportionately they win a disproportionate number of medals. So in a recent Games, I think there were 7% of athletes on asthma medications, and they won 15% of the medals. So officials are concerned that maybe they're getting some benefit from the asthma medication, a performance benefit, which is separate from just treating treating the asthma itself. And there have been a lot of research into it lately, and it has been shown that if you take the equivalent medication, that's the Ventolin or the albuterol, if you take that as a pill, which is available in some countries, that will increase your performance, because it does have an effect similar to adrenaline. in some ways. So it can actually make your heart pump faster and make you feel a little bit more jacked up. If someone's gone a little overboard on taking their Ventolin, they may find themselves a little bit edgy. So when they take that medication orally, there is evidence that will improve your performance. So that has been banned. But there's not too much evidence that any of these puffers can improve your performance. And that's the medications that these people are taking at the Olympic Games and winning a disproportionate number of medals. So there have been a lot of very controlled studies to try to show that these medications are improving people's performance. But so far, there isn't any good evidence yet. We've just applied for a grant to look at sort of the variability in how people respond to this medication, because people with different genes will respond differently to medication. So that's one of the things we're going to be doing in our labs, is looking at the genetics of this, of how people respond to the asthma medication, to see if people with certain genes will get a performance benefit from this medication. So we'll have to stay tuned on that one. But so basically the jury's still out, but there's a lot of people doing a lot of research, because there is that sort of concern about why do these people win twice as many medals.
We have really about 2 minutes left, and I want to just mention vocal cord dysfunction, which we talked about before the program. And is a mimicker of asthma, or a confounding variable in asthma and also in all of this exercise? Do you want to just mention that and maybe help people who think they may have it after hearing this discussion and what they might be able to do?
Certainly. So vocal cord dysfunction, what it refers to is when we breathe normally, our vocal cords are in the way, because they're like a reed on a clarinet. And as we breathe in, they'll pop out of the way, and all the air will get into our lungs unobstructed. But in certain individuals, they have a sort of a paradoxical vocal cord action. So instead of opening, the vocal cords close, and that can narrow the airway, and it can make it difficult to get the airway through, and it can also make a sound. And that sound, we call that sound stridor. So when people have vocal cord dysfunction, this can be triggered by exercise, and it's particularly common in high-level athletes, a little bit more common in female athletes than male athletes, but it can give a lot of those symptoms, the shortness of breath and the difficulty with performance. The one thing that's different from it is it's usually occurring when you're breathing in, and you get that sound, that stridor, and that's that sound that you'll sometimes hear. So that's one of the clues that tells you that perhaps this is not asthma and it's vocal cord dysfunction. The other really important point is that it doesn't respond to the asthma medication. So it's something to think about if someone has been treated for exercise-induced asthma and the medications don't seem to be helping. Maybe that's not the right diagnosis, and you want to make sure that something else isn't going on, such as vocal cord dysfunction.
And you can have both at the same time, asthma and vocal cord dysfunction.
Yes, yeah.
Thanks.
Certainly.
Go ahead.
Oh, and sometimes it can be triggered by a reflux, where the acid from your stomach comes up your throat into your esophagus, and it can actually irritate the vocal cords as well. So that's something that you have to look at as well in people that aren't responding to asthma medications when they're exercising.
Well, our thanks again today to Dr. Michael Cole from the University of British Columbia. I very much enjoyed talking to you, and I'll see if I can send you a little information and see if it's correct about the size of airways over time. I may be wrong, but I'll see what I can come up with.
Yeah, no, that would be great. I'd like to learn about that.
All right. We'll be back next week. This is Line 1.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.